aren't spending all their time on the internet. A lot of people do. And there's this young man out of Virginia that over the last couple of weeks is all over the internet. He made a song on his Android phone called Rich Men North of Richmond. And it sort of became a sensation, all kinds of millions of views, everybody watching it, everybody wanting to know who this guy is. It's sort of a protest song about how difficult it is to be poor or working class in America. But the culture war being what it is, once it got out there, people began fighting over it. Is he a Republican? Is he a Democrat? Is this authentic? Is this astroturfing? Is this about class? What really is this whole thing about? It sort of reminded me about a few years ago, J.D. Vance wrote a book, Hillbilly Elegy, and that sort of made a wave in the culture because people had a sense of, well, the poverty that's in that Appalachian region out east, and you know, we've heard a lot of news about the opioid epidemic and all of the difficulties, joblessness, drug use. Of course, J.D. Vance grew up in a house where he was, you know, in and out of the care of his grandmother because he would often, his mother had a drug problem, she had other behavioral problems, and so he was often mostly raised by his grandmother. J.D. Vance went into the Army and used the GI Bill, and he was pretty smart, so he got into Yale, and of course, eventually became a U.S. Senator. And I remember when the book came out, everybody was sort of the same thing. People were reading the book and like, well, is he going to be a Democrat or Republican? Is he going to go into politics? And of course, he did, and is a senator from the state of Ohio. I don't think this guy's going to ever be a senator of anything. A few years ago, he had some traumatic brain injury, working a job, and since then he suffered with depression and substance abuse, and recently decided that his life wasn't really going in a very good direction, so he decided to, you know, really to pray out to Jesus and reach out to God and try to get clean and record some of his music, and then of course, whoosh, this thing hit the social media waves, and suddenly all kinds of people know his name. And he's turning down record deals, but I mean, the world's beating a path to his door. He's got a trailer that he bought on Craigslist for $700 on a piece of property, and I'm sure, well, we'll see what happens to him. That quickly, he's on Joe Rogan. I know a lot of you don't even know who Joe Rogan is, but Joe Rogan is asking questions about this transformation, about religion, and Joe Rogan was taking the conversations in a variety of different ways. His real name is Chris. Anthony Oliver is sort of his stage name. And he says he doesn't go to church, but he's, you know, he believes in God, he knows God, he knows Jesus, he reads the Bible, especially loves Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and he credits God with his big turnaround. It sort of reminded me of Mama's Religion that J.D. Vance wrote about in Hillbilly Elegy. This is young J.D. Vance. He's a boy. He's staying with his grandmother because once again, his mother's fallen off the wagon and she's gotten a little violent, and so he kind of finds shelter with his grandma. I stood in the narrow hallway that separated the living room from the dining room and asked Mama a question that had been on my mind since she ordered Mom to drive us home safely. I knew what she'd say, but I guess I wanted to hear reassurance. Mama, does God love us? She hung her head, gave me a big hug, and began to cry. The question wounded Mama because the Christian faith stood at the center of our lives, especially hers. We never went to church, except on rare occasions in Kentucky, or when Mom decided that we needed in our lot, all what we needed in our lives was religion. Nevertheless, Mama's was a deep, personal, albeit quirky faith. She couldn't say organized religion without contempt. She saw churches as breeding grounds for perverts and money changers. And she hates what she called the loud and proud, people who wore their faith on their sleeves, always ready to let you know how pious they were. Still, she sent much of her spare income to the churches in Jackson, Kentucky, especially those controlled by Reverend Donald Eisen, an older man who bore a striking resemblance to the priest from The Exorcist. By Mama's reckoning, God never left our side. He celebrated with us when times were good and comforted us when they weren't. During one of our many trips to Kentucky, Mama was trying to merge onto the highway after a brief stop for gas. She didn't pay attention to the signs, so we found ourselves heading the wrong way on a one-way exit ramp, with angry motorists swerving out of our way. I was screaming in terror, but after a U-turn on the three-lane interstate, the only thing Mama said about the incident was, "We're fine, goddammit. Don't you know Jesus rides in the car with us?" You get to know people like this, don't you? And I'm sure many of you know people like this. And I get a sense of that young man and J.D. Vance's grandma that this sort of faith, these sort of assumptions, these ideas have gotten kind of broadly into the culture. And they sort of inhabit our culture. This young man wrote this song protesting the state of the world. His complaints about government, of course, he's talking about Richmond, north of Richmond, of course, he's talking about Washington, D.C. But songwriters, black and white, for many years have been writing songs of protest about the situations that they grew up in and the circumstances that they face and the inability of the government or the church or the society to really come to grips with the problems that there are. If you're poor, even struggle and hard work won't necessarily ensure or secure a good outcome. So we love a story when someone who comes up from nowhere makes it huge. They become rich and famous and influential. And quite honestly, it's usually when they become rich and famous and influential that a whole group of new problems start for them. But we'll leave that there for now. This, in fact, is an old story, one of my favorite movies. Frank Capra's Meet John Doe in 1941 is a story of a woman who's just fired from the newspaper, but the editor says, "And you still owe me an editorial." And so she thinks, I'll fix him. And so she makes up a fake John Doe letter, and she says, "This guy just wrote a letter, and because of the state of the world," this is 1941, Hitler had just basically controlled all of Europe. The U.S. didn't know where things were going. England was teetering on maybe surrendering, didn't know what they'd do. And so this woman makes up a story of a guy who says, "The world is terrible. Because the world is so bad, I'm going to throw myself off of the roof at City Hall." And suddenly the town hears about it, there's a big uproar, "You gotta find this John Doe, you gotta get him a job, you gotta rescue him." But of course there's no such man. So they grab some rube off the street, and she keeps writing stories for him, and he becomes this major celebrity, protesting the state of the world. This is 1941. Every decade we'll see someone like this rise. There's something deep underneath that's in our culture, that when we see this, it grabs us. And we think, yes, the world isn't right, and something should be done. And it emerges every few years, and people find it enormously powerful. And it's both old and fresh, over and over and over again, it sort of flows through our culture like a wave. Something is wrong, and we love it when the little guy rises, and out of obscurity, someone makes it big, and we all sort of vicariously celebrate through him. Last week, we talked about the mature Paul that we find in these prison letters of his. He's not anticipating going city to city to city, planting new churches. Now he's in prison, and whether he's in a temporary imprisonment in Ephesus or a longer imprisonment in Rome waiting for Caesar, he knows that his life is going to be different, and in some ways for many people, sort of over. And so last week in this first chapter of Philippians, he said, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Whatever God does with me, he will bless me, and I trust him, and I know that he's good. There's joy and peace, even in a corner, when you're stuck. And he's writing to a beloved church knowing that they will struggle. Whatever happens, Paul says, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then, whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in the one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that man will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interest of the other. We know that when we see someone coming from humble beginnings, trying to do the right thing, sharing with those in need, it's inspirational. There's an ideal that's sort of set before us, and we look at that and we say, wow, that is beautiful. And Paul is telling this whole church, why don't you as an entire church be like this? It's so different from the Roman way of life. A manner of being that is so radical, so different from the Roman way to power. Augustine called it the libido dominandi, this libido, this hunger for domination. Paul said, among you in the church, it's not to be that way. And this is perennial. This has gotten deeply rooted in our culture. But it's also deeply rooted in our family systems, deeply rooted in our intuitive understanding of what a good father is and what a good mother is or what a good friend is. It's the person we want to be seen as being, but don't always want to pay the price to become that person. It's the person that everybody wants to be with, but it's a lot harder to be than to be with. It's this vision that transformed the relational ideal of human beings. And when we catch a glimpse of it, Christian or no Christian, God believer or no God believer, when we see it, we're attracted to it, we're drawn to it, and we want to be with that person, and we want to be like that person. What Paul writes here is likely a song that he's quoting. Now again, if we look at N.T. Wright's thesis, and perhaps in the early 50s is imprisoned in Ephesus, or some of the other ideas about Philippians that maybe in the early 60s, I mean 0060s, not 1960s, in the early 60s that he's imprisoned in Rome, he quotes a song. And somehow this song must have emerged in the early Christian community. And quite likely it would go from church to church to church, not unlike the way music goes today. From church to church to church. People hear it, intuitively they sort of like it, and they say, I want to sing it because there's something beautiful about this song. And so Paul takes it and in a sense sings it for them. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God as something to be used to his own advantage. But rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant. Being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Now, This is such a powerful song, I think, because we can all connect to it. If we live lives in a way that we're doing quiet, unseen, humble acts of service one to another, one that not everybody sees. I get from Joanna, Lil's friend who comes to Sunday school, she always talked about her mother in Mississippi. They'd watch things going on in the community, and she as a little girl would kind of look to her mother to be, well, what are you going to make of this, Mama? And her mother would always say, God knows. God knows. Paul is saying that all of these little things that we're doing, all these little struggles that we have, all of these little things that maybe nobody knows about or nobody wants to take the time even to listen, God knows. God sees. And in the story of Christ, we see all of that service will not be forgotten. Now, a lot of these guys that we see just come from humble origins, but Jesus, of course, comes from heaven, empties himself, is born a vulnerable baby amongst a people that are not terribly important and certainly not successful, and is subject to all the things and humiliations that we are. And he gets humiliated even further and abused and beaten. And in none of this he sins, and so God raises him to the highest place. And this idea, this story, this narrative just grabs something deep within us. When we see someone humble rise out of some Christ song beauty, we pay attention and we're attracted to it. As a community, we begin to value it, and we afford status to those who practice it and adopt it as a communal ideal. Therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose. And so Paul says, this isn't just for us as individuals. Imagine a community in which this is the ethos. Now, it's difficult that in a community, you'll get uneven performance, just like each of us has our own uneven performance. But with this at the center, instead of us cheering people who are taking advantage of each other and sort of climbing over others to get up on the ladder, a community instead was encouraging one another and caring for one another and putting the needs of others ahead of our own. Do everything without grumbling or arguing. It's kind of hard to do, isn't it? Kind of hard to do at home. So that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky. Isn't it interesting how we call musicians, movie stars, sports celebrities, stars? The whole culture navigates by them. And what Jesus is saying is become like Christ among each other, and you will shine in the church. And you know, that really is true. And even though in a little church like this, and I'm not going to name names, we know the saints among us. And we know when people shine. And when we see that, we begin to navigate by that. Then you will shine among them like the stars in the sky as you hold firmly to the word of life. And then I will be able to boast on the day of Christ. Remember, we talked about that last week. Paul's always looking to the day of Christ. And we will be able to boast on the day of Christ that I did not run or labor in vain. Paul is sitting in prison, and he has visited these churches. And, you know, we spent a long time looking at the church in Corinth. And these churches have problems, and there's arguments and grumblings and all kinds of stuff going on. And Paul says, use this as your standard. Navigate by this. And if you do that, then even though I'm sitting in prison, not knowing if I will live or die, I will go to my grave in peace, knowing that all of the struggles I went through have been worth it for your sake. But even if I am poured out like a drink offering on the sacrifice and service coming from your faith, I am glad and rejoice with all of you. So you too should be glad and rejoice with me. This is a challenging community life to aspire to encourage each other to live out. Paul said, let these poured out like a drink offering. And for people who had seen lots of temple sacrifices, this is probably taking some precious wine or something valuable and taking it to the altar and just seeing it poured out. And you can imagine everybody watching that, looking at the value of that wine and thinking, boy, I'd surely like to have a taste of that. And they're going to take that and they're going to pour it on this large, smelly, gory, hot thing that is an altar. Is it a waste? That's what a lot will think. But Paul is saying, if this becomes the life of your community, then this gift that I've been giving you will not be in me. Now, this young man says his family calls him and checks in on him because they want to know how he's doing. And for good reason, because, of course, everybody wants a piece of him. You know, the t-shirts that he's wearing, t-shirt makers have, you know, made lots of them and are selling them on the internet. And, you know, he's been on Joe Rogan. I'm sure he'll run the whole circuit. And politicians are going to say, hey, do you want to run for county supervisor? And places are going to say, well, if we give you a new truck, can you do commercials for Ford? I mean, everything's going to go. And right now he says, no, I don't want to change my life. But you know what? Poverty is hard. And bills come due. And when his truck breaks down, if Ford is saying, please take a new truck, just be seen driving a Ford, what's going to happen? I don't know. We should pray for the young man. In some ways for him, things have never been better. But in other ways, things have never been so at risk. Our fallen nature plus potential usually leads to calamity. You know, you see someone sitting by the side of the street panhandling. Ironically, probably the worst thing he could do is hand them $1,000. They might be dead by the next day. The challenges aren't usually on the front end in that moment of deliverance rush. Christ doesn't find power, however, in his public ministry. He always had it, being in very nature God. The temptations are right at the beginning of his ministry because that's actually the challenge. Jesus, with all that power, how will you use it? Will you use it for yourself? It's revealed in the day of Christ, where he hangs on the cross. His mockers say, he saved others. Where's that miraculous power now? And they spit on him. And his friends hide. And he says of those who are doing the crucifying, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And it would be a nice story to say that while he was on the cross, the presence of God was never closer to him. But no, he uses the words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Philippians 2 says that Christ's song says, because of this, he was raised to that highest place. What does that mean for you? It's probably in those moments of your life that are darkest, that you are tempted to take some easy way out, that you feel like family and friends, and maybe even your God has abandoned you. It's in those moments that God often really does the work. He reigns above us. He reigns through us. He reigns in us. And sometimes, despite us. Now, with this meal, we say, do this in remembrance of me. It's written right there on the front of the table. And it's a strange meal, of course, because if we were to have a meal, maybe we'd all sit around a table, and you could do this way too, but of course Jesus is celebrating the Passover meal with his disciples, And they all know the routine. They've all done it since they were children. And then Jesus starts changing things up, because he does this on the night he was betrayed. Now, you're not betrayed by an enemy. You expect an enemy to move against you. You're betrayed by a friend. On the night that he was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And they were all used to the Passover celebration and the story of the unleavened bread and the blood on the doorpost. But Jesus broke the bread, and then he said words that they'd never expected. He said, "This is my body, broken for you." This is the Christ song in wheat and water and heat. And he said, "Take, eat, remember, and believe. Do this in remembrance of me." Why? Every time you eat this bread, you proclaim the Lord's death. What does that mean? It means that this death that he died is right there in that Christ song. So the humiliation and the resurrection and the glorification. And so as we ourselves participate in this today, and as we ourselves participate in it during the week, this ought to be the mind that we possess.